Right now on Tech Radio, Apple on the hook for $1 billion. But there is a plan.
Hi, I'm Artemis. I am a computer-generated AI voice, and you're listening to Tech Radio.
Every week online and on air with RT Radio, we bring you the very latest in tech. You're welcome to episode 1009, where this week, Apple and Google have been falling over themselves, making changes to avoid EU fines. But for Apple, maybe too late. We're also talking about the International Women's Day and Women in Tech. And our guest today will be talking about passport queues and the pros and cons of using AI to make them move faster. Let's get into it.
From techcentral.ie, this is Tech Radio with Dusty Rhodes and Niall Kitson.
I'm Dusty. Joining me, as always, is our editor-in-chief, Niall Kitson. Niall, I suppose we'll start with Apple because there's three big stories.
We'll start with Apple. I mean, we usually sort of split the news up between us. And this week you went, nope, I got the news. I got this. I'll go off and I'll compile it. And I come in to read the notes. And what do I see? I see a bunch of Apple stories. I'm like, yeah. Oh, Dusty's got a bee in his bonnet over something this week.
Yeah, Cal Surprise. I suppose, listen, let's start with the 1.8 billion euro antitrust fine from the EU, which I think brilliant, because Spotify filed a complaint. And basically, here's the thing, right? Apple charged 30% of anything that goes through their app store, which is ridiculous.
Well, okay, open to debate. We'll do that in a bit.
It would be very high, okay, if you were to put it that way. All right? Like if Tesco were taking 30%, that would be considered high. If, you know, an agent for Ryan Tuberty was taking 30%, even that would be very high.
Okay, I'm going to play devil's advocate in a bit, but you explain what's happened.
So there is that. All right. So, but this is only on, then you're left with a case where you're selling your product for a tenner a month everywhere in the world, except on Apple, where they're taking 30%. So what do you do? Do you try and eat that and operate at a loss on the Apple platform? Or do you charge Apple users more money? It's a bit of a thorny situation to be in. Anyway, Spotify filed a complaint with the EU and the EU agreed with Spotify. And I think one of the things that came out of it was not just the 30%, but the fact that Spotify or nobody else is allowed even mention the fact that other payment options are available off the Apple platform. They're not able to say, well, you know what, on Apple it's going to cost you 13 quid a month, but if you sign up directly on our website, it'll cost you 10 a month. They're not allowed to say that, okay? So that was the complaint that was filed. The EU agreed with them at 1.8 billion. This, I think, is interesting because I think the EU actually fined Apple a euro. And then the 1.8 billion was a top up.
Well, the original fine was 500 million.
Ah, you've got it. All right. Okay, grand. Yes. And then the rest of it was a top up.
You're right. The rest of it was a top up. The rest of it was, we know you're not going to feel that at all. The Competition Commissioner, Marguerite Vestager, came out and said, you know what? This is a parking ticket for Apple. We know. But. This is related to the Digital Markets Act, which is into force now as we speak. And we are in this period where I think an awful lot of grace will be given to companies as they struggle, inverted commas, they've had a lot of time to prepare for this, to bring their operations into line. So I think we're going to see big tech across the board get a lot of fines, but they'll be smaller in nature, say smaller, you know, inverted commas, in terms of the percentages, because the maximum percentage fine under the Digital Markets Act is 10% of your global turnover. Massive money if you're someone like Apple or Microsoft or Google or Netflix, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. 10% of your turnover, okay, considering that, you know, the profit margin of a company might not be more than 10%. It's huge.
Yeah, absolutely huge. But when you have particularly profitable companies, the bottom line figure that may be coming into Europe or the Exchequer, very impressive. However, when it comes to the company itself, you've really got to send them something that they will sit up and notice, and 10% is pretty much it. Now, here is the devil's advocate bit, right? Now, I think in a lot of ways, the App Store has been a victim of its own success. Because as you remember, when the App Store opened in, what was it, 2009? Mm-hmm. Apps were generally small in nature. Basically, you know, a lot of them were mobile websites with, you know, a slightly different UI over it, maybe. And not a lot going on. Often done by, you know, individual developers. Most apps do not make money. It's people sort of tinkering around, maybe looking for something to have in their portfolio so they will get employed by a much bigger company. Fair enough. No problems with that. I mean, if your app isn't making money, you know, 30% of nothing is nothing. So that's not a big deal. The App Store terms and conditions were developed at a time for, you know, it was expected that apps at best would make a modest amount of money for maybe individual developers, maybe small companies, that kind of thing. Now we have the massive tech companies who are basically looking at it and going, well, look, we make an awful lot of money. Why should we have to pay you an awful lot of money for something you are expecting not a lot of money for? Yeah. So I think Apple's argument is just because you're wildly successful, it doesn't give you a pass on anything. You signed up for this. You signed up for the developer terms and conditions. The fact that you're hugely successful, I mean, good for you guys, but I mean, you're still playing on our field. Now, the Digital Markets Act expressly says you cannot dictate the terms of the playing field anymore, right? You can go under the DMA. You can go to a different app store for Apple apps if you want. And you can download stuff from there. Similarly, if you want to use a different payment system than Apple, and this is where we are here with the Spotify action, you should be able to do that. If you want to use your own payment system, you should be able to do that. And that's how we got to this point. But in playing devil's advocate, again, Apple did not know the App Store was going to be successful, did not know, we couldn't have foreseen how profitable it would be for some companies.
You're talking about 2009, okay? Yes. That was, what, 15 years ago. They have done nothing in the interim to change.
Yeah.
30% by anybody's stretch of the imagination is a large chunk of cash. All right. And I will go with Apple's argument that it doesn't matter if you're turning over billions and billions, you still pay the same rate as the guy who's turning over 100 quid. All right.
Yeah.
So there's nothing there. But just the fact that it's so much, that it's the percentage that I have a problem with more. And I like the thought of, it's actually funny now that you say, because Google Play have the same thing, okay? In that they have to allow other Play stores on their platform, same as Apple have to do, and allow other payment processes and stuff like that. And I'm wondering, will people go with those other stores? Because one of the advantages of, certainly with Apple and possibly with Play, is that Apple will check apps that are going onto their store, and they will check them to make sure that they conform to a certain policy and technical standard and safety and stuff like that. And there is a reassurance about that. And also making a payment via Apple, because they are a respectable company, is also very reassuring. So even though another app store may be available, I wonder, would I use it, especially that I'm already set up? However, the important thing is that we have the choice, which we didn't have before.
That's true. However, if, you know, Apple were to say you can buy your Spotify subscription through the app on the Apple App Store, where Apple already has my payment details and keeps them very, very safe, am I more likely to use that service than to go up to Spotify and kind of have to input my details from scratch?
Of course, you'd use the Apple service, but the thing is, will you pay an extra 30% per month to use the Apple service when it's available?
Or are Spotify happy to eat a 30% loss?
Well, there you go. That, it's back to the 30%. It's too much, right? Here's a thought that I had during the week. Write this down. Apple used to make computers. Now, they make money.
Well, they're very good at it.
Very good at it. That is all that Apple is about. It's just about money. How can we get people into our system? How can we keep them in there? There's another. This is the bit that the Apple, the 1.8 billion was like, yeah, I'll tell you the court case or the proposed court case that really made me happy during the week, that made me smile, that made me jump up and down and go, yes. All right. It's a proposed class action lawsuit against Apple in the States. And it's specifically, it's against Apple Cloud, right? Because if you're using iCloud, like all of the cloud services, you can blah, 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 whatever. But there is a restriction with Apple on certain file types that are hosted. Okay. And they will exclude certain file types. Some of them will include app data and some of them will include device settings that you can only host them with Apple's iCloud. You can't use them on whatever, Dropbox or whatever else. Yeah. All right. So it becomes just way more convenient to use Apple. All right. Mm-hmm. And they have done that. It's a technical restriction. It's just written into the software. There is no technical reason why people can't do that with other services, but they make theirs more appealing and easier to use so that you would use that without having to go through all the hassle of doing it with the other. And it's simply a software restriction. You know that I went absolutely bananas when I spent thousands on a brand new Apple computer to find out that I couldn't use cloud the way I had been using it with the older machine. And again, it's a thing to keep you within the Apple garden and to pay more to Apple for the same service that I had before.
Again, playing devil's advocate on this, there are apps for Microsoft, for Google, for Dropbox. It's not like you can't use these services with Apple devices. No, they are there.
But there are restrictions with them, is what I'm saying. All right. And that the Apple service is the only one that will do certain things.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you don't have the choice if you say, oh, well, actually, I want to use Dropbox for everything. Mm. You can't.
Yeah. Well, I will give an example of where I've run up against this and gotten very cranky over it. Is the lack of support for lossless audio on iTunes. So I had a couple of things downloaded as FLAC files. Not supported in iTunes. Cannot be played in iTunes. So I was like, okay, that's a bit annoying. Not happy with that. Because I like my tunes. I like a bit a quiet room in which to listen to them.
And if you use the Apple lossless codec, no problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Apple lossless, it's out there.
That's what I'm at. Like, you know, kind of, if you want to use another lossless codec, well, why shouldn't you on the player? It's that kind of walled garden stuff that really just, I mean, oh my God, I wish this was television because you could see my face crunching up and just pure frustration. Like, you know,
quite impressive, actually.
Finally, on Apple this week, they released their M3 MacBook Air to absolutely no aplomb or interest from the world.
No. Do you know what I love about this story?
Go on.
In the context of what we've been talking about,
yes,
and you know the you know legal action in Europe, the general annoyance over App Store practices and certain apps that come preloaded and are just easier to use than the competitors. What do Apple do? They go, look over here.
we've
got a new MacBook with an M3 processor.
But I don't think it worked because nobody cared. All right. And I'm not surprised because when you look at the laptop, it's the same as the M2 MacBook Air. It's just got an M3 processor in there and it's $100 more expensive.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Here's the thing. And for me, this is that episode of The Simpsons where they came up with an alternative to Malibu Stacy. Which I can't remember the name of the doll, Lisa's feminist alternative to Malibu Stacy. What happens? Malibu Stacy shows up with a new hat And Lisa's doll is immediately forgotten. So yeah, Apple, you guys suck. Oh wait, a MacBook Air in 13 and 15 inches with an M3 processor, all is forgiven. And it's only €100 extra. And come on, like that's not a bad deal.
This episode is released to the world Friday, the 8th of March, which is International Women's Day. And Niall, you've got some stories kind of in and around that.
Yeah, I got three stories that landed in my inbox. So some giving me cause for concern and others, unfortunately, reinforcing things that we've talked about on the show over the years. As we know, there is a problem when it comes to getting women involved in careers in science, technology, engineering, and maths, or STEM. And there's a couple of reasons for it, which every year they just seem to get reinforced over and over and over. Engineers Week is coming up, which is sort of vaguely related to this, because it's about promoting awareness and promoting careers in STEM. And they issued a result, a survey conducted by Ipsos BNA, and they found that 39% of women said they did not view engineering as a suitable career. 39, more than a third of women.
What was it for men?
29%.
All right, okay.
So, you know, it's the old perception of these are jobs for men, these are jobs for women still persists. And I see it in my daily life as well.
Now, hang on. Can I just make a point here, all right? Because there's always the half glass full, half,
Yeah, yeah.
61% of women view engineering as a suitable career. Think about that.
Yeah, yeah.
Continue.
Yeah. Okay. And I'd say that is testament to a lot of the progress that has been made. In terms of, you know, engineering, just to pick it, because I've got, you know, some notes in front of me on it. 13% of all professional vacancies in 2022, the entire jobs market, 13% were for engineers of various types. It's a massive sector. If you want to be well paid, if you want to get into a job, look at engineering. Similarly, if you want to get into a really good job, take a look at cybersecurity, because you know that's where it's at. A similar report that I found in England. So you know there is a little bit of transference going on here, but a survey of 500 women working in the technology sector found that 76%, when asked, said they had experienced gender bias or discrimination in the workplace at least once, which is a big increase on the last time this survey was conducted in 2019. So it's kind of the latent argument is, okay, if you're interested, that's nice, but you still will probably have to deal with inappropriate behavior at some point, maybe a hostile work culture. But to bring it down to those elements that we alluded to earlier, that we do know why so many women and girls are turned off careers in STEM, it comes down to parental expectations. It comes down to peer pressure. In particular, we see more girls do biology at Leaving Cert level instead of chemistry and physics. And it comes down to a lack of role models. That old argument that you can't be what you can't see, which I picked up on this show in discussion with, I think it was Lorna Martin from Fidelity Investments a couple of years ago, talking about this very subject. So the lack of role models, the peer pressure in terms of, you know, sticking with your mates, getting into whatever they're doing, and then, okay, what kind of jobs do my folks think I would be good at? Because there are certain professions that are dominated by women. Apparently HR, dominated by women. PR, dominated by women. So the weird thing is that very often I will end up dealing with women to get interviews with men. They're still there in that chain. It's just they're not visible. And that visibility issue is certainly something that comes to the fore.
I think things are changing. And particularly when you look at the news every night and the minister for this and the minister for that, we have so many female ministers now. I think it's fantastic. I am going to stick with that fact that you gave just a few moments ago. And I'm going to stick with my flipped version where 61% of women feel that engineering is a suitable career. Anybody who's thinking of it, if I was talking to any kids, I would say, will you jump into that? For God's sake, they are crying. You said what, 13%? Percent of all jobs in the country are engineers. I talk to engineers as part of my my job, and one of the things that is always coming back is trying to find staff. Oh my God, they are crying out for staff. You know, kind of if you want to get into engineering, regardless of your gender, all right, terrific career to get involved in, and brilliant money in it, and great opportunities as well. And the fact that 61% of women feel that engineering is a suitable career, I think is brilliant. I interviewed an engineer for a podcast and I loved what she said. I said, how did you get into it? And she said, well, I was a kid and I was walking along and I saw this man who was building a bridge and he had a Mercedes. And I went, that's a nice car. I'd like one of them. And I went up and I said, what do you do for a living? And he went, I'm an engineer. And she goes, Grant, that's what I'm going to be then. And I went, boom.
What? Boom. How very Irish. How very Irish. As Bono once said, in some countries, when somebody is, you know, very successful, they get worshipped and they get praised and this sort of thing. In Ireland, when somebody is successful, people look at them and go, I'm going to get him.
Or they go, I'm not going to go over and ask him for his autograph just in case he thinks he's famous. I wouldn't give him the pleasure. Anyway, another story to do with this is with Ireland and how we compare with Europe and European countries with support for women-led startups. What's the story there?
Yeah, again, a report that we're citing here. This one is from Tech Ireland. And this year we saw a slight increase in the number of Irish women-founded startups being backed. Last year, it was, in 2022, it was 72. 2023, it was 77. Overall, however, in the market, we've seen a tough one for venture capital investment. So, you know, there might be an element of tallest dwarf here, and there were only two deals recorded that were in the over 10 million euro range. And those were from Tipperary-based Shorla Oncology and Dublin's Proverum Medical. So MedTech doing actually pretty well here. But there's a lot less money than there was. However, a lot more female-founded companies knocking about. So it's a little bit of, you know, swings and roundabouts. There are good news stories there, but seeing as there's less money sloshing about there overall, this seems to be a down year across the industry. People that we've talked to in particular, sort of looking at new clients coming along, looking at how they're spending their marketing budgets, seeing as we're in media, that kind of thing. Everything is very quiet this year so far, whether it's an element of skepticism has crept into the market, whether we're into sort of a real post-COVID slump, whether we're into kind of wait and see what comes up this year, seeing as we're not entirely, maybe people are asking ChatGPT what their marketing strategy should be.
They probably are. And God help us if that's what they're basing their marketing strategy on. However, anyway, listen, International Women's Day, I think the most important thing to come out of this and that we should recognize is that things are changing. And I like that. So for our last story today, there was an Irish survey that came out during the week about adults and their attitudes and opinions to their devices, to their smartphones and their tablets. And it's kind of surprising the results that came back.
Well, this was one of those surveys that you see the thing, you see the headline and you think, God, this is going to be kind of fluffy and the stats are going to be a little bit kind of, if you dug into them, you'd find actually, no, that's not what they're saying at all. Yeah. However, smartphone usage for most of us is more than 5 hours a day. And when you look at that figure, you think that's a load of nonsense. 5 hours a day, forget about it. But I sit at my desk all day. Mm. I've got a smartphone in front of me. Whenever I move, it's got a motion sensor on it. So when I jiggle a little bit, the screen pops up and invariably there's some sort of notification on it. And you go, oh, right, that could be important. Better check that out. And these little moments, they certainly add up, don't they?
Well, if you've got 5 minutes here and you've got 5 minutes there and you only do that, you know, kind of 10 times during the day, that's almost an hour in itself. All right. Yeah. And then there'll be another part during the day, maybe on a commute or after dinner or whatever time you have. You just, I'll just check out my phone, blah, 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 whatever. Yeah. Do a crossword on it or whatever. Yeah. So like I can absolutely. And then, of course, YouTube is another thing. More and more people just getting their entertainment off YouTube or listening to podcasts. Yeah. Good on you.
Your podcast app of choice.
There you go. So, I mean, 5 hours a day, I can see that. I'm guessing that teenagers will spend more times on smartphones than adults, yeah?
Yes. Overall, they certainly do. But this brings a whole bunch of concerns because, you know, ask anyone who loves chocolate to stop eating chocolate. You get that craving. You get that. On the interior, you're like, yeah, I could give that up. That's not it. It's only one part of my diet. And then your body goes, where's that refined sugar and cocoa and caffeine thing that I really like? And it gets really, really hard to get rid of. We would undoubtedly see the same thing if we had our smartphones taken away. But as adults, we have certain views of technology and social media and whatever. Younger people have very different views. In particular, if you look at usage patterns for the likes of TikTok, which we're not on because we are old men, but also things like Instagram, where people present the best versions of themselves all the time. And there is that kind of FOMO of, gosh, I'm not, you know, living up to my potential unless I'm, you know, on a par with this, on a par with the highlights. So we can't live without our smartphones. We love that dopamine hit. And the bits that we really do like following on our smartphones, not great for our mental health.
There's one other thing I wanted to ask you about that, if you can dig into it. I saw an ad today for a tablet. All right.
Right.
The ad started off with a teenager kind of like, you know, just waking up in the morning. And the first thing they did was they reached over to their bedside locker and the tablet that they were selling, of course, was there. Mm. And it's the first thing that they look at. Now, I'm sure a lot of people check their phones first thing when they wake up. Was there anything in the survey about that?
Yeah, I mean, on a personal level, that certainly used to be the way I operate. Also, you know, a very quick shout out to Deloitte because this is their survey. We didn't do this ourselves. Mm. So yeah, is it the first thing people do in the morning? I'd say an awful lot of people, yes. Have you got an actual stat in front of you?
I saw part of it, and it's one that is stuck out in my head, was that the majority of people will check their phones within 30 minutes of waking up.
Yeah, I think it's three quarters of people. It's absolutely massive. If it's there, people just reach out and they check it. Now, I mean, I've got alarms set for my morning. I've got my smartphone in my hand when I switch it off. You know, what's the first thing you can do? Let's have a look at the screen, see if anything has happened.
Yeah, that's it. It's the news app. And I specifically want to know, did a nuclear bomb go off while I was asleep? That's exactly.
Is there anything outside that I can step out into? Is there a country left?
There you go. Listen, Niall, as always, thanks for keeping us up to date with the news of the week.
Delivering Irish tech news since 2006, this is Tech Radio.
If someone was to ask you what is the most boring part of air travel, chances are that included in the list will be waiting at passport control. It's slow, it's boring, it's the worst thing ever when you just want to get home. But what if AI could do the same job as passport control in a fraction of the time? Sounds great. But what happens when such an automated system breaks down? Or what happens when such an automated system gets hacked? Delaram Gulpegani is a researcher at ADAPT, the Science Foundation of Ireland Research Centre for Digital Content. She shared a vision of a better consumer experience for us with some strings attached.
Over the last few months, we've gotten used to the broad strokes of the EU AI Act, this sort of risk-based approach. Now we know a little bit more about the Act. Indeed, we might have it in our hands properly by the time this goes live. And there are a few little wrinkles added in there, which kind of have echoes of GDPR in terms of understanding the nature of information that might be held on you and what you can do about it.
Yeah, the overall objective of the EU AI Act is trustworthy implementation and use of AI in the EU. And it tries to protect citizens' health, safety, and fundamental rights from the negative impacts of AI. And for this, it adopts, like you said, a risk-based approach where AI systems are categorized based on their level of the risk that they have on this three key areas of concern. So we have like prohibited AI systems, which can't be deployed within the EU. We have high-risk AI systems. And here we have systems that are a safety component of products or sub-products that are already regulated, such as toys, machinery, elevators. And also there are specific applications of AI, which are counted at higher risk, like systems that are used in education for assessing students. And then there are systems that are having like limited risk and there are transparency obligations for that. For example, if you are using an AI system for generating an image, so you need to say that this image was generated using an AI system. And there are systems which has like minimal or limited or no risk. And there are codes of conduct that you can voluntarily comply to.
So that kind of raises a question that we know the broad strokes of what falls into each category roughly, but you kind of need a more systematic approach as well, because as greater and more innovations come along, they will need to be classified or reclassified. And I imagine there's an awful lot of voices in that conversation, whether they be technical, whether they be legal, whether they be ethical. You know, it seems like there's an awful lot of cooks at work here.
Yeah, so like the high-risk areas are defined in annexes of the Act. So there is this adaptability in the regulation now that the Commission has the power to add to the list of the systems. So if, as the time goes by and there are innovative technologies appearing, and also there are new ways of mitigating risk and impacts of AI, they have this power to adopt the list of high-risk obligation based on the advancement in technology.
So then in looking at making things quite methodical or streamlining that process, is there a software-based solution here that we can, I suppose, take away the problem of automation by automating something else?
Well, so like for specifically about determining high-risk AI systems. So one thing is just going over the list of the systems. So like I said before, there is Annex 2, which lists the systems that are already regulated in the EU, like toys, machinery, elevators. So these are kind of quite clear. But the applications of AI in Annex 3, there are mainly applications that are used in the public sector. So we have education, we have employment, we have law enforcement. And in the, like I suppose in the sensation area, there is a kind of a lack of standards to help providers and also users of AI to determine whether their system's high risk or not. In ADAPT, we try to analyze the risk, the list of high-risk applications of AI, trying to find how we can help people to determine whether their systems are high-risk or not. And we realized that with like five concepts, which are like the domain of the system, the purpose of the system, the capability, for example, if you're using voice recognition, if you're using facial recognition, the user or what's now called deployer of the system, like if it's a university, if it's a public body, and the subjects of the system. So if we are making, for example, decision for students or people who are traveling, then what combination of this, you kind of get an idea whether your system is high risk or not.
That's really fascinating that something that seems quite benign, like going through an airport, has a number of high-risk AI systems in there. How do you sort of manage that risk? Is it a matter of making people more aware that, yes, you're going through here, and the fact that you've done something very convenient with your passport has actually created a data point that might be useful to a bad actor? Like, how do you get across that message without putting people off, you know, more convenient applications of pretty worthwhile technology?
It's one of the most important things here is AI literacy, which is explicitly defined in the AI Act, that those who are using the system or those who might be affected by the system should be aware of their risks and harms of the system. And but I think one of the other things should be like aware, making people aware of how to interact with the system. So for many things, we have like safety instructions for airplane safety calls. We have medication leaflets. We have construction safety signs, which are kind of in a very simple way and kind of very efficient way. They try to communicate the key element of safety. For AI systems, I think that should be the same. So there is a need to communicate how to use the system, first of all, and also how they can kind of opt out of the system's decision. So if there's kind of an option available to challenge the system's output, if there's something wrong, if the system is not accurate, there's a need for transparency and kind of genuine communication of risks and limitation of the system, and telling people what to do if something goes wrong.
So do you think we're going to see a case where people, you know, as they become more AI literate, will become more questioning of the technology that's around them? Or do you think it'll just be a case of, well, I know there are protections out there, that's fine?
I think it really depends on the kind of the trust on the regulators and who are enforcing this regulation. By the time goes, we will see the kind of effectiveness of the AI Act. But I hope that we will be in a position that like people trust the decisions that are made by the system, or trust those who are enforcing the regulation, so that we can benefit from the use of AI system. At the same time, we are sure that like the risks and harms and negative impacts of AI are mitigated.
Lastly, I know your work has involved sort of that space between AI and semantic web. So tell us a little bit about how that works.
So in my work, I'm specifically looking into risk management obligation of the AI Act. I'm trying to build vocabularies and ontologies around AI risk and AI risk management to assist with the compliance with the AI Act. I'm also looking into the technical documentation requirement of the Act. And I hope that with the ontologies and taxonomies that we are building, there we would be able to create this kind of common language that is lacking and very much needed to facilitate the conversation between those who are involved in implementation and enforcement of the AI Act. And it is broad range of stakeholders. We have sanitation bodies, we have regulators, we have companies who are developing new systems, and we have people who are affected by the use of the system.
So it's a very broad church that you're dealing with. So how large a sample are you working with just to make sure that you have, you know, one, enough voices and that they're represented in, I suppose, a fair and proportional manner?
So my work is based on mainly the EU AI Act and the standards that are being developed at the moment. What we try to do is just communicate with different types of stakeholders to gather their feedback and opinion about the taxonomy.
And so once you, I suppose, have developed this, or lingua franca, I suppose, of AI, do you see this as being a facilitator of additional conversations? Do you see it as being an aid to lawmakers or to legislators or academics?
Well, so at the moment, there is this EU vocabulary. So, and it is kind of common to have this kind of vocabulary within the EU. So one of the things that I'm thinking of is having AI risk vocabularies that facilitate, especially when you have like different bodies and different member states involved in development and deployment of an AI system. This can be helpful. It also promotes interoperability. So when you want to have a document and integrate it with a different documentation that you have about your models or data, so it can facilitate the integration of your existing documentation, and it helps that like semantic interoperability if you want to send over the documentation and information for audits, for conformity assessment. And
that was Dilarum Gopagani, a researcher at ADAPT, the Science Foundation Ireland Research Centre for Digital Content, chatting with Niall Kitson.
This is Tech Radio with Dusty Rhodes and Niall Kitson.
That's it for our show this week. Do check out some of the stories online that we didn't have time to talk about in the podcast today. What do we have, boss?
Yeah, for those who are interested in cryptocurrency, Bitcoin has surged past the $65,000 a coin mark. Google.org has invested $1 million in child protection in Ireland with the charity Bernardo's. Mm-hmm. And lastly, half of businesses are still not using fiber broadband.
Wow. You'll find those and more online at techcentral.ie. And of course, we have our daily newsletter, which you send out, keeping you up to date with what's going on as well. You can sign up for that for free on the website as well. We're back again next Friday with a brand new show online and on RT Radio 1 Extra, of course. Do remember to share our podcast with a friend in the tech biz or just has an interest in tech. Just tell them to search for Tech Radio Ireland on Apple, Spotify, or now on YouTube. Until next time, from myself, Dusty Rhodes, and from Niall Kitson, thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.
Remember, you can get the latest Irish tech news with hourly updates, daily newsletters, and more at our website, techcentral.ie. Share the knowledge and invite a friend to listen. Search Apple, Spotify, or YouTube for Tech Radio Ireland, or listen with RTE Radio 1 Extra. Tech Radio is produced by dustpod.io for techcentral.ie. From me, Artemis, live long and prosper.